and the personality of God there, how he creates, and what comes of creation in the form of saha, strength of the mind, doja, strength of the senses, and bala, strength of the body. So body, mind, and senses, the living entity gains from the creation and is able to do things with this body in creation. You're going to hear in tomorrow's verse particular Sanskrit words used in tomorrow's verse, like trivrit. Trivrit, and the three kinds of life vigor, Prabhupada translates that as. And Jiva Goswami expands on that and says that that's saha, oja, and bala. Strength of the body, mind, and senses. And another word that's used in the verse, tad vibhutir. And that vibhutir refers to Prajapatis, those who assist with the creation. And as we can list a few Prajapatis, like Daksha, very famous one, because the word for vibhutir is called prowess in tomorrow's verse. And prowess is synonymous with expertise. And Daksha, whose name is very fitting, very expert in progeny and continuing the creation. And there's other Prajapatis also, but he's very famous. Excuse me. We're getting a summary of the how creation works and how the Lord expands to be able to create. And we're hearing from His Holiness Devi Amrita Swami yesterday that it could be seen, it can be viewed that the primary creator of this universe is the desires of a living entity, and Krishna is secondary, and then that makes Brahma tertiary creator. It could be viewed like that. And yes, and as the question was asked by Keshava Prabhu a month ago when he was giving class on the verse previous and talking about the third canto in general and his teaching the third canto, the students of his Bhakti Vaibhav course were asking, why creation so many times in the third canto? Can we go on to the fourth canto, please? And he said, and so he asked the question, why is creation talked about in so much detail, three times at least, in this canto? And then the answer was given by Prabhu, that it's because we need to know how much maya we're in to understand our position. Which brought to mind the nice example that Prabhupada gives. He was talking to a particular disciple who was a little confident, overconfident with his service, and he brought him, Prabhupada brought this disciple to the globe of the world that he had in his room at Los Angeles. And he said, he first started with, we hear there's Karana Dakashaya Vishnu, Gaba Dakashaya Vishnu, Shira Dakashaya Vishnu, huge expansions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then out of the navel, from Gaba-dakashaya Vishnu, comes Brahma. And then from Brahma, the secondary creation of the 14 planetary systems. And then from those planetary, in those planetary systems, there's so many worlds and universes. And within that one little planet called Earth, there's many countries. And then out of the many countries, there's this place called America. And out of America, there's many states. And one of the states is Los Angeles, and there's lots of streets, roads, buildings, and there's a little tiny La Cienega Avenue, which Hare Krishna owns most of, and we have one little tiny temple with lots of devotees, and in that one little temple, there's this one little tiny such and such devotee, and that's you. And it's like bringing from the expansive, you know, creation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead down to the little tiny us. So we're this tiny little soul, and we're hearing about the the glories of the soul yesterday in His Holiness Devamrita Swami's fantastic class, that the soul is this tiny little microcosm, which is, what, 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair, puffed up to 6'1" in this body, with this great false ego. So, the expanse of the creation, it's good to understand our limited, tiny situation. And actually, that's the beginning of knowledge. And that can be the beginning of devotion. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita in the 8th chapter, sorry, 13th chapter, texts 8 through 12. The first line, Amanitvam, Adambitvam, Ahimsa, Shanti, Arjavam. Amanitvam, Adambitvam is basically humility and pridelessness. That's the beginning of knowledge. We can understand, and as Maharaj was saying yesterday, that we need to approach the right person in the right mood to be able to hear and gain transcendental knowledge. We must approach not only the right person, but with the right attitude. An attitude of gratitude, but in the right attitude of, yes, understanding we're very tiny and minuscule, and we need help in this situation that we're in this vast ocean of material existence. So, the living entity is bewildered by its external situation. You'll notice that when the living entity is in a baby's form, in, isn't it? When from birth, growth, to, you know, to maintaining, and there's some reproduction and of byproducts, and then there's some dwindling and we vanish. We understand there's six stages of existence. But when the living entity is in a baby's body, it's constrained by the confines of that body. It's bewildered by that body. You're bewildered by the body that you're in. We are bewildered by this machine, this yantra, which the living entity is, isn't it, traveling in. And for the time being, that this bewilderment continues, and one's activities and one's mentality is, again, like I say, constrained by this by this confined shell. Like when you play with, if you play with babies, especially the youth, you know, you can play peekaboo with them. Confirmed. Peekaboo gets them every time. Like you hide behind something and then, you know, they're watching and then and you jump out from behind. Peekaboo, and they're like totally stoked. They go, wow, he disappeared and then he appeared again. How did he do that? And then you peekaboo. And it gets them every time. You know, in the baby's body, they're bewildered. I said, even when we come into this lifetime as a devotee, even when we take birth in a devotee's family, which is a birth to die for, using that expression. Well, actually, we did actually die for it. That's why we had to take birth again, as Krishna says, isn't it? Second chapter, text 27, that for the living entity, for one who dies has to take birth again, and for one who takes birth has to die again. It's a constant cycle of repeated birth and death. But the point is that the living entity is bewildered by this. Now, as you grow, isn't it, under the gun of material existence and under the misconceptions of material life, one's decisions, one's intelligence, one's understanding of life is limited to the body that one's wearing. And when we become teenagers, we make stupid decisions. Stupid decisions to whatever it may be, to, isn't it, for our association that we keep and the jobs that we choose and the courses that we choose in university. What's it for? Ultimately, for sense gratification. Making stupid decisions. Again, being confined to this body, bewildered by it. And so when the teenagers become adults, they just become stupid adults. And I don't mean that in a nice way. I don't mean to sound so harsh here, but but you see how it is that we've made silly decisions because we've been pushed around by material energy, and we've identified with our, with our families, with our friends. We're identifying with others who are under the same illusion. And if and when we do actually try to conceive of spiritual knowledge or understand a higher power or a higher existence, a controller, a greater being other than us, then we superimpose our limitations on that, isn't it? On that living entity, on that controller, on that greater power. We project our frailties, our limitations. Yeah, I'm limited, I'm tiny, I'm bewildered. So my source, well, if there is a God, then that God must be affected by the same thing, affected by the same misconceptions. But there's so many examples, isn't it? Even on this earthly planet, of of even ordinary human beings that can do amazing things. Mystic yogis, magicians. There are magicians that can do amazing things. There's this magician that would, he had about 5,000 people at Hudson Bay or whatever, this place in New York where they have the Statue of Liberty. And he had all these people seated about 100 meters away from the Statue of Liberty. And by a wave of his hand, he made the Statue of Liberty disappear. And it couldn't be seen from the air or from the land. It couldn't be seen from planes. It couldn't be seen from helicopters. They're all wondering, oh my God, it's gone. They were struck with wonder. And where's the statue? It's like the Statue of Liberty is many stories high. But he made, just by one wave of his hand, he made it disappear. And they were wondering, will we get our Statue of Liberty back? Where is it gone? And then he's a very famous magician, this one. And so he waved his hand again, and then it reappeared. And he made some sentimental testimonial about we're taking our liberty for granted, and the Statue of Liberty was the symbol of our liberation from our limited. So America is liberated, and Statue of Liberty is our, of course, given by the French some years ago. But so he made it like a statement like this. But anyway, he's just an ordinary man, and he was able to perform this illusion in front of thousands of people. Another story that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur tells, talking about the potencies of God and the potencies of Krishna's mystic power. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur tells this very nice story of this magician and his family. They were invited by the king and queen on this festival day, and they wanted to enjoy nice fun. And this magician and his family performing very nice tricks. And they were all the king and the queen and the jesters and everyone gathered. They were laughing. They were having a wonderful time. They were struck with wonder, but with these magicians' tricks. And then the queen was so happy with these tricks that the magician was performing that she wanted to give them a nice gift. So she took her own gold diamond necklace and gave it to the wife of the magician. There's a magician, his wife, and two sons. And so she received the necklace, and they were very thankful. They were very grateful. And then the two sons, they wanted to play with the necklace. And they were saying to mother, oh, mother, please, please, can we play with the necklace? And she said, no, no, please, please. They were begging. And so she said, okay. So she gave the necklace to one of them, and they started playing. And as children are, they're playing for a couple of minutes, and then one of them says, I want this necklace for myself. And then the other boy says, well, if you want it for yourself, then I want it for myself. And they started fighting, and they started yelling, and they started shouting. And they became so angry that they simultaneously drew swords and simultaneously cut each other's heads off. The heads fell to the ground. Blood all over the court. And the queen, oh my God. And the mother was, oh my God, that was, I gave them that necklace. And she was, you know, she was distraught. And so she picked up one of the swords and cut her own head off. Head rolls on the ground and there's blood all over the court. And more blood, it's almost like waves now. And then the husband, the magician, says, oh my God, my wife and my two children, they're dead. What's the use of me living? So he picks up a sword and cuts off his head. There's blood all over the court of the royal throne. And then the queen and the king, they don't know what to do. They're like, oh, what an inauspicious thing. And they get the servants to clean up the blood and put the bodies in the river. And then that night they couldn't sleep. They said, what an inauspicious, horrible thing that happened in the court today. I'm like, God, how can we? They couldn't sleep. They were rolling. They were suffering very bad. Then the next day, this note comes. And the note says, by the way, I am that magician. And I thank you for the gift that you gave us for the first performance. But did you not like the second performance? Because you gave us no gift for that. If you'd like to give us a gift for that, then this is my address. Come and see us. And so the king and the queen, oh my, they brought all gifts. They brought all an entourage. And said, could this be true? Are they alive? So they went to the house and they knocked on the door. And then there's the magician and his wife and the two sons playing with the necklace saying, oh, thank you very much. So they were this mystic power. If tiny living entities can perform illusions like this, you know, what is it God cannot do? Also, just recently, this is documented in the newspapers in India. This famous magician from India called P.T. Sarkar. You've heard? Good friend of yours? Family? Oh, okay. But you've heard of him. And his son's actually quite famous also. Following in the tradition, and he does magical acts also, but he invited many dignitaries and many famous people. He said, I will put on a magical show for you tomorrow. Be there 4 o'clock sharp. And he invited people like, this is in India, people like the Prime Minister, few dignitaries. The royal family was there in Calcutta at the time. He invited the royal family. They're from England, as you know. And he said, be there 4 o'clock sharp. I'll put on this show for you. And in America, all over the world pretty much now, there's a saying that they ridicule the Indians by saying that they have Indian standard time. When you say 4 o'clock, that means 6:30. But for the English, it's not like that. When you say 4 o'clock, you better be ready at 4 o'clock. So they all gather at 4 o'clock or a minute to four, and then so 4 o'clock comes, and then soon it's 4:15, and they're looking at their watches. And then it's 4:30, and it's 4:45, and they're looking at their watches, and then by 5 o'clock they're saying, "We're going to kill this man. We're going to imprison him. He's insulting our family and the royal family and our hierarchy and our entourage by this insult." And then just after five, P.T. Sarkar, he walks in casually, chewing pan. He says, "So, I'm glad you could make it." And they were yelling, they were screaming at him, "You blasphemer, you nonsense, you offender." And he says, "What's wrong? Why are you yelling at me?" So he says, "Well, you're an hour late." He looked at his clock and he says, "An hour late. It's 4 o'clock. I'm right on time. Look at your watches." And they all look at their watches and it's 4 o'clock. But just an ordinary man can do something like this. And again, if God, you know, can empower a tiny living entity to do like this, we have famous examples in the scripture of those that defy God's will and limit God to their own limitations and understandings. Kamsa is a famous example. Kamsa and his ministers of course, as you know, excuse me. That comes to knowing that the eighth child of Devaki was going to kill him. And of course he was fearing like this. He was eating and sleeping Krishna. Constantly fearing. And actually Narad Muni glorifies Kamsa in the seventh canto. He gives the five examples of absorption in Krishna. The five famous examples. Well, the five types of absorption in Krishna is lust, envy, hatred, affection, and devotion. Those five ways of being absorbed in Krishna, that Kamsa was so fearful of Krishna, as you know, that when he left his body, he attained Krishna. So Narad Muni gives the examples: Gopya, Gopa, Kamad, Baya, Kamso, Gopi, Kama, which is the gopis by their lust, Kamsa, Kamsa, and Bayo. Bayo, as you know, means fear. Chadya, Dveshyad, that Shishupal and others, another envious by their envy. Pandava, the Pandavas by their affection, and also Yudhishthira Maharaj. And of course, this is Narad Muni speaking to Yudhishthira, and he says, by myself and others, by devotion. So that's in the seventh canto, first chapter, text 30, 31. And he's saying that by these five ways that these persons attain liberation. But then he says, actually persons like King Vena, they couldn't be absorbed. King Vena is, you know, is Anga Maharaja's son. He was the very tyrannous, wasn't he? He was killing his friends, and Vena was a nasty piece of work. But then, as you know, from his body, once he died, came famous Pitya Maharaj. Management personified. But anyway, getting off the track here. But he said, a person like Vena couldn't think of Krishna in either of these five ways and didn't attain liberation. Anyway, Narad Muni actually glorifies Kamsa, saying that his absorption in Krishna, even in the form of fear. So anyway, Kamsa's fear in Krishna. And when he was sending the demons, the shape-shifting demons to kill Krishna, each of these demons actually saw they got darshan of Krishna. And just before they're about to fight with Krishna, Krishna actually manifests his Vishnu form. And so they'd see that Krishna, this Krishna they're about to kill, is actually the Supreme Person, is actually God. But despite of seeing that, they're, you know, they thought, no, still we can kill him. Because again, this they might get, you know, like a very short, very like instant of seeing that Krishna is God, but then that's covered very quickly. Back to the demoniac mentality that I am greater than God. If there is a God and he has powers, I have greater powers. So they saw him as in his visionary form, but then they sort of shook that off and then tried to kill him anyway. Kamsa was the same. Kamsa saw his visionary form also. Not only before Krishna, as you know, he fights with the wrestlers. Krishna and Balaram kill Chunura and Mushtika. Who, by the way, Chunura and Mushtika are part of Kamsa's ministers who would advise Kamsa. When they heard that this eighth son of Devaki was going to kill Kamsa, they were the ones that advised. And also Narad Muni, also, as you know, he came and he stirred up things and sped up the pastime so that Krishna would appear. And it's actually Narad Muni, along with his ministers, is saying, well, how do you know which one's the first or the eighth child? And so God comes to thinking, well, yeah, maybe I should just kill all of them. And so he did, and committing these atrocities. But Narad Muni's very clever ploy, understanding who these personalities were that were taking birth in Devaki's womb, who they were in their previous lives and how they had to get theirs, and Kamsa was the instrument for that. But Narad Muni speeding up the pastime, and his ministers pretty much supporting what Narad Muni is saying, that yes, you should kill all eight sons, not just the eighth. Because how do you know which one is the eighth? And they gave him the example of the lotus. There's so many petals on it. But it's circular. And it's symmetrical, but it has so many petals on it. But how do you know which one's the first one, and which one's the fifth, or the fourth, or the third, or the eighth? Because it's round. Which one is the first? And so Kamsa would hold on to this lotus every year. And when Vasudev would bring the son of Devaki, because remember, he brought the first one, true to his word. Vasudev never spoke a lie in his life. Kamsa knew this, he understood his integrity. So he brought him, the first son. He said, no, you can take him back. I'm worried about the eighth one, not the first one. Anyway, so as we just heard that, the ministers and Narad Muni are saying to Kamsa, you should kill all of them, because how do you know which one's Vishnu? So he did that. and then when his ministers were saying to him that, well, now the eighth son is born, then he's in the village there somewhere. And so, of course, this is when he starts sending the demons. First demon was Putana, as you know. He said, kill all of the children born within the last 10 days within the village. So she went round and got all the babies and ate them and did atrocious things with them. And Kamsa was still fearful, though, because of the demigods, also like Indra and Brahma, and they were saying to him, "Don't worry about the demigods." And again, this is another example of limiting God. That they were saying, "Don't worry about Brahma, don't worry about Shiva, and don't worry about Vishnu. Don't worry about Brahma because he's too involved with and engaged in universal affairs. Don't worry about Shiva. He's locked in meditation. He's just engaged in meditation all day. He won't disturb you. And Vishnu, he's locked in all the devotees' hearts. That's where he resides. And he's not going to give you any problems." And so Kamsa got confidence from this. Again, limitations, limiting, God and his devotees to the confines. So Kamsa is fearing like this. His fear is intensifying. And then, as you know, when Krishna comes to Mathura, Krishna and Balaram, isn't it? They enter Mathura by way of Akrura, brings them from Vrindavan, and they get to the gates, and of course they deal with Kuvalyapid, and then they deal with the washerman. They deal with, kill the washerman, and then then there's the seams person and the garland maker. Krishna awards them liberation because they're making cloth for and garlands for Krishna. And then they're being worshipped by all the ladies in Mathura. And then, of course, they meet Kubja. That's a whole other story in and of itself. Very interesting details to that pastime and her relationship with Krishna. So I'm just giving a brief glossed over sort of summary here to get to Kamsa being taken out. Then, of course, they take rest that evening. But then that evening, as you know, Kamsa sees all these kind of anomalies, these bad omens. He sees himself, isn't it, in a cart with donkeys, massage, covered in oil, with garland, naked, covered with oil and with a garland, which that's how they deal with, isn't it? Dead persons. So he's seeing all these visions. His fear is so intense. And this is what Narad Muni is talking about, that even he's so absorbed in Krishna by fear that he's seeing Krishna at every moment. Or he's seeing his external material energy at work also. He was seeing so many omens. Not only was he dreaming, seeing himself without any head. He wasn't seeing his shadow. The shadows in his place were turning into serpents and coming to attack him. And he was like in fear all night. And of course the next day his heart's palpitating. And even though he's surrounded by all his ministers and kings and so many people and in the arena, and the kings had reserved thrones, and he's surrounded by his ministers. And so another instruction there is that no matter how externally or materially powerful one may be, death will still come for you. Death is more powerful than anything externally that you can hold on to, anything you can be attached to. And no matter how many weapons you have, how much money you have, how much food you have, how much associates or how powerful they are, these shape-shifting demons he sent to Vrindavan, they're very powerful personalities, and they have great histories of who they, Kuvalyarpi was like, he was not just stronger than 10,000 elephants, like he was like as strong as 100,000 elephants. And he was taking out big elephants in the past, and anyway. So he was surrounded by these great persons, but his heart was palpitating, the fear heightening. And then, as you know, then of course Krishna and Balaram defeat the wrestlers, and then of course Kamsa cannot handle this, and then he gets up and he says, and he stops the music and he stops the drums beating for Krishna and Balaram's victories. Of course he says, Krishna and Balaram should be restrained and the cowherd boy should be put in prison. My father Ugrasen, who's always been on the side of, of Vasudev, should be killed, and Vasudev should be killed also. And of course when Krishna heard this, then his anger intensified. He flushed, actually it's said that Krishna flushed red with anger. His bluish complexion turned red. And his beautiful lotus-like eyes, the bloodshot, copper-like, and he's looking at Kamsa, and he jumps up to the dais for his chambers. And then, as you know, Kamsa jumps off of his throne, and he's has his sword and hither and thither, and he has his golden diamond-studded crown, and he goes to swing at Krishna. And he's actually moving around like a hawk, the previous acharyas say. He's very quick and he's actually like a great warrior. And he has mystic powers also, Kamsa. But he's moving around like a hawk. But what does Krishna do? He grabs him by the hair. And the previous acharyas are talking about how was it that he could grab his hair because it was covered by the crown. But he simultaneously grabbed his hair and knocked his crown off his head. And then he threw him to the ground. And actually, the previous acharyas say that Krishna throwing Kamsa to the ground was how he killed him. Other previous acharyas say that when Krishna jumped on him, like a big wrestling jump, when in the wrestling ring, isn't it? And one gets up on a post and the one's on the ground and they do a big sort of like belly flop on them and land on them. Yeah. Krishna did that. He jumped off from a great height and landed on Kamsa. And apparently that's what killed him. And of course we have Srila Prabhupada saying in the Krishna book that he straddled his chest and he struck him. Now going by that story, going by Krishna striking Kamsa, every blow that he was giving Kamsa, he's saying this one is for Devaki. The suffering she felt while you had her imprisoned. Pow! This one, and then he said, he was naming each punch. This one is for Vasudev and his, his integrity lost by your, you know, your indignifying him by putting him in jail. Pow! This is for the 18 clans that you drove out of Mathura in your, you know, in your taking over of all the lands. Pow! And so each one he gave a reason for. And then each time he was punching Kamsa, it was like he was going further into the ground. And of course it split apart all of his armor. And it cracked the ground like all around. And then he picks Kamsa up. And he said, and this one is for your killing all of my brothers and sisters. And then he headbutts him. He was a fool. And then he's lying back on the ground. He's like breathless. And then he looks at Krishna. And he looks next to Krishna. And he sees Krishna's Vishnu form. And his vision changes at that point. He's like the height of his fear. And he's seeing Krishna. And he leaves his body at that point. Seeing Krishna in his Vishnu form. And he realizes, this is explained by the previous chapter, he realizes that actually this is the supreme source of my power. So understanding Krishna and his expansions and understanding Krishna's energy, it's very important to understand our limitations, but that we're totally dependent on the supreme independent personality of Godhead. As it says in the first verse, first chapter, first canto, very famous verse. Janma jasya yatan vayad itratas chachesya bigya abigya svarat. Abigya, totally knowledgeable, all cognizant, and svarat, completely independent. So the supreme, all knowledgeable, independent personality of Godhead is the ultimate shelter for the living entity. And so understanding this is why we're hearing in the third canto that yes, the cosmic creation, but understanding how much Maya we're in, so that we can hear from the right person, in the right mood, in the right mentality, at the right time, at the right place, to hear how it is that we should be taking shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I'll stop there. Ask for any comments, questions. Yes, ma'am. Tadvidi panipatena paripashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnana jnanas tattva dashvaha dashvahi. The right questions are in relation to how one can submissively serve the spiritual master. Because as you know, Prabhupada says in that purport, absurd inquiries are condemned. So the right question is to do with seva. Tadvidi panipatena upadekshanti sevaya. Tadvidi panipatena paripashnena sevaya. So to do with seva, to do with how you can use your body and mind and your energy, your youthful energy, how can you use that properly in the service of the Guru. Be properly engaged. And yeah, 100%. How to put all of your heart energies into, well, hearing and chanting about Krishna, of course that's service too, but you know, how to be practically engaged. Your mind, body and words, isn't it? Should be all engaged. So that's the proper type of questions to be asking. And the right mentality is, it's also expressed in that verse, the right mentality is one of submission. And as we hear, His Holiness Devamrita Swami says that submission means acting on what you've heard. That's what submission means. It's not just, yes Guru Maharaj, or yes Maharaji. And then we go off and do other things. Might hear some instruction from them that we go and do the complete opposite to what he says. Submission means acting on the instructions that have been given. Yes, ma'am. Well, actually, the question is, if Krishna's name means all attractive, reservoir of pleasure, then why is it that not all living entities are attracted to Krishna? And just as he asked for the repeating of the question you were just saying, is that pretty much the entirety of your question? So, actually every living entity is attracted to Krishna. Those that are conscious of their relationship with Krishna, in other words, those who are devotees, they're attracted to Krishna in all of his features. Those who forget that they are devotees of Krishna, they're attracted to his external energy. So actually everyone is attracted to Krishna, just some remember who Krishna is and some don't. Some are under the care of Krishna and his energies, mainly yogamaya, mahatmanasti mamparta, daivin prakritim ashrita. So those who are under yogamaya, they're attracted to Krishna in that way. But those who are under mahamaya, his external energy, they're attracted to Krishna, they're attracted to the glaring energy of, isn't it, of mahamaya. So, always attracted, but in that way, it's just when we become, when one becomes a devotee, then we're understanding Krishna and all of his energies again, which is the point to the third canto, and why we're hearing about his creation, so we understand. And oh yes, and that's another thing I wanted to say. Thank you for reminding me, and that is that creation is also part of Krishna's lila too. And Prabhupada says it's not just rasa. Isn't it not just the rasa dance and his killing of the demons and his, you know, Kurukshetra war and not just, you know, pastimes with his devotees to hear in the Srimad Bhagavatam and other Puranas, that's nectar, but also his creation, also how he creates. The devotee likes all aspects of Krishna, actually, all aspects of Krishna's lila. So that, yeah, so when you hear about creation, actually, we should relish. Only three times in the third canto, we should hear about, you know, the details of the cosmic manifestation. 27 times in the third canto. Why not? They should be asking Keshava, can we study the third canto again and again? The fifth canto too. And by the way, Srila Prabhupada is he's teaching, as you know, through the Temple of Vedic Planetarium. He's teaching, isn't it? And he's smashing the scientists. Like, this is how the cosmic manifestation is. This is how the cosmos works. You should see the working model. They've got a miniature to scale model of how, of what's actually going to be in the dome. Of, and it's actually going to be a working model of the universe, all the planetary systems, all the way on up to Goloka Vrindavan. And it's going to be a huge, massive structure. But we just had a, I was just in Mayapur and we had a tour of the TOVP, and they've got, and like I say, a miniature to scale version of how the cosmos looks according to the fifth canto. And then, like you said, you see it, and in comparison to the building itself, which is massive, it's a massive dome. I won't get into the details of the time, but I mean, I just wanted to say this, that And this model is like moving to the day, to the very minute. And it's actually going to give like the correct calendar date, not only for the Vedic calendar, but also for the modern Western calendar. It'll be moving in such a way where the planets will be all... You'll see actually how the planets are in, you know, where they actually are, according to how the universe is actually working around you at the same time. And it's going to be constantly moving. This is like state of the art, something that's never been done before. Not only in any temple, but in any kind of isn't it? Any building or any museum or any, you know, might be like a really small version of it with, you know, the sun and the planets. You know, they might have had that, and you might see that in some, you know, museums. Really baby-like model of that. In comparison to this, it's nothing. Anyway, it's huge. So Prabhupada is actually teaching the scientists how the Vedic model works and what the reality of the cosmic situation is. And he always said that he wanted to kick on the face of the scientists with his boots. But the funny thing is, he never wore boots. He'd wear like really nice shoes or like slippers. But the TOVP, that's his boots. And that's the kicking on the TOVP is kicking on the face of the scientists. And saying, this is the reality. And this is actually the complete working model of the Vedic cosmos. Shri Prabhupada ki. Pancha Ashram Bhagavatam ki. Take all things.